Listening to Emily Dickinson poetry, you have to put on something akin to your Shakespeare ears. If you have ever been to a Shakespeare performance, you know that the first few minutes are quite disorienting. You can tell that the actors are speaking English, but it's no English that you recognize. But as the play goes on, your ears and your brain adjust. And then the play begins to make sense. This is how it is with Dickinson poetry. The more you read it, the more you understand it. The more you see how Emily Dickinson's masterful wordplay reaches right to where poetry reaches, to the heart before the head. From the smallness of her bedroom, Emily Dickinson commanded galaxies. Amid the constraints of the 19th century, she shatters all convention. The Belle of Amherst, as she has become known, Emily Dickinson was born on December 10th, 1830, in Amherst, Massachusetts. Here's what Wikipedia has to say about her. It makes you wonder what she would think about something like Wikipedia. Although part of a prominent family with strong ties to its community, Dickinson lived much of her life in reclusive isolation. After studying at the Amherst Academy for 7 years in her youth, she briefly attended the Mount Holyoke Female Seminary before returning to her family's home. Considered an eccentric by locals, she developed a noted fondness for wearing white clothing and became known for her reluctance to greet guests or later in life to even leave her bedroom. Dickinson never married, and most friendships between her and others depended entirely upon correspondence. They were letter relationships. Dickinson was a recluse for the later years of her life. While Dickinson was a prolific private poet, fewer than a dozen of her nearly 1,800 poems were published during her lifetime. Fewer than a dozen. The work that was published was usually altered significantly by the publishers to fit the conventional poetic rules of the time. Dickinson's poems are unique for the era in which she wrote. They contain short lines, typically lack titles, and often use slant rhyme as well as unconventional capitalization and punctuation. Many of her poems deal with the themes of death and immortality, two recurring topics in letters to her friends.
This is tie the strings to my life, my Lord. Tie the strings to my life, my Lord. Then I am ready to go. Just a look at the horses, rapid, that will do. Put me in on the firmest side, so I shall never fall. For we must ride to the judgment, and it's partly downhill. But never I mind the steepest, and never I mind the sea, held fast in everlasting race, for my own choice and thee. Goodbye to the life I used to live, and goodbye to the world I used to know. And kiss the hills for me just once, then I am ready to go.
But never I mind the steepest, and never I mind the sea, held fast in everlasting race by my choice and thee. Emily Dickinson was troubled from a young age by the deepening menace of death, as she called it, especially the deaths of those who were close to her. When Sophia Holland, her second cousin and close friend, grew ill from typhus and died in 1844, Emily was traumatized. Recalling the incident 2 years later, Emily wrote that it seemed to me that I should die too, if I could not be permitted to watch over her or even look at her face. She became so melancholic that her parents sent her to stay with family in Boston to recover. With her health and spirits restored, she soon returned to Amherst Academy and continued her studies. More than any other poet that I know, Emily Dickinson dances in the space between life and death. She careens to the very edge of oblivion before steering the horses away from the edge. And for Dickinson, death and God are her constant companions. She believes we are most alive when we know we will die. We are most alive when we are ready to leave this life at a moment's notice. But this readiness is not fatalism. Nor is it suicidal ideation like you might find in Sylvia Plath or Dorothy Parker. For Dickinson, God is only half in charge of her life. She is an equal partner with God in the decisions that they make together. Held fast in the everlasting race, she writes, by my own choice and thee. In writing these lines, she addresses God in the traditional informal tense of English. God is her friend, and God is there with her. She has agency over her life, as we all do, and she's wise enough to know that she cannot completely control life. Life will, in a sense, take her where it will. And this is a truth that we do not often like to acknowledge. Yesterday, I did the second funeral for a 17-year-old Concord boy since August. There were 750 people in this room. There was not a seat to be had, and 150 people stood for the 90-minute service. Both boys died in train accidents. Both left loving families who will carry grief and loss for the rest of their lives. We do not know what will happen to us either, and we cannot avoid life. These boys' short lives will be remembered, but their families will never be the same again. One of the reasons that I urge you to keep your ties to First Parish in Concord strong is because you never know when you will need your friends here. You never know when you will need a minister. You never know when it might feel as if God has betrayed you. Life often veers toward a chasm. We need each other to bring us back to safety. We keep living.
Because I could not stop for death. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, he knew no haste, and I had put away my labor and my leisure too, for his civility. We passed the school where children strove, at recess in the ring, we passed the fields of gazing grain, we passed the setting sun, or rather he passed us. The dews grew quivering and chill, for only gossamer my gown, my tippet, only tulle. We paused before a house that seemed a swelling of the mound. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice but a mound. Since then, 'tis centuries, and yet, Each feels shorter than the day. I first surmise the horses' heads were toward eternity.
From the mid-1850s, Emily's mother became effectively bedridden with various chronic illnesses until her death in 1882. Writing a friend in 1885, Emily said that she would visit if she could leave home and mother. "I do not go out at all," she wrote, "lest father will come and miss me or miss some little act which I might forget should I run away." As her mother continued to decline, Dickinson's domestic responsibilities weighed more heavily on her, and she confined herself within the family home. Withdrawing more and more from the outside world, Emily began in the summer of 1858 what would be her lasting legacy. Reviewing poems she had written previously, she began to make clean copies of her work, assembling carefully pieced together manuscript books. 40 collections she created from 1858 through 1865, eventually held nearly 800 poems. No one was aware of the existence of these books until after her death. "Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality." The most famous lines ever written by Emily Dickinson perfectly sum up a well-lived life, including hers. "Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me." An old friend interrupts the comings and goings of everyday life to go for a carriage ride. "We slowly drove, he knew no haste," recalls Dickinson, as she sees vivid moments of her life pass by. In her poetry, there is no warding off death. There is no struggle, there is no fear. Her faith allows her to go with death willingly. "The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality." Death is not the end. Heaven is a possibility. And the immortality of having left so many poems, even though they were left in secret, allows Emily Dickinson to leave this mortal plane unconcerned. Although she continued to write in her last years, Dickinson stopped editing and organizing her poems. She also exacted a promise from her sister Lavinia to burn her papers when she had died. As death after death succeeded, Dickinson found her world upended. That summer, she had seen a great darkness coming and fainted while baking in the kitchen. She remained unconscious into the night, and weeks of ill health followed. On November 30th, 1885, her feebleness and other symptoms were so worrying that she was confined to her bed for a few months, but managed to send a final burst of letters in the spring. What was thought to be her last letter was sent to her cousins, Louise and Frances Norcross, and simply read, "Little cousins, called back. Love, Emily." On May 15th, 1886, after several days of worsening symptoms, Emily Dickinson died at the age of 55. Dickinson's chief physician gave the cause of death as Bright's disease and its duration as 2.5 years. Dickinson was buried, laid out in a white coffin with vanilla-scented heliotrope and a lady's slipper orchid, and a knot of blue field violets placed about it. The funeral service, held in the family library, was simple and short. At Dickinson's request, her coffin was not driven, but carried through fields of buttercups for burial in the family plot at West Cemetery on Triangle Street. I have an odd little theory that I think Emily Dickinson would have liked. Though it would never stand up to theological scrutiny, it is poetic enough to be admissible. My theory is that after we die, we go wherever we believe we are going. If we believe in heaven, then we get to go to heaven, harps and angels and all. If we believe in reincarnation, we are reincarnated as some other being or some other person somewhere else in the world. And if we believe that there is no afterlife, we are simply done. Our body goes into the ground, and all that is left of us are our memories. And since none of us can know for sure, it's as good a theory as any, right? And wouldn't it be comforting to know that all of us were simultaneously right? There's plenty of heaven in Emily Dickinson's poetry, too. For her, heaven is a place. It is a destination. Heaven's gates swing wide for all to enter. Even a reclusive poet is welcome there. I have known a heaven like a tent, she writes. You've done it again, Miss Dickinson. You've turned something familiar on its ear. You have made us care in a new way.
I've known a heaven.